Janae is so talented, and every time I hear somebody that has a mastery of the spoken word, the first thing I think of is, I can hardly even remember my own name. How they get through that, I have no idea. But we're going to talk. We're going to talk for a few minutes about marriage. Let me just ask by a show of hands, how many of you are married? Yeah, that's a good number of hands, How many of you are planning, you have on your calendar to get married? Like, I mean, get some engaged folks, a couple engaged folks, a couple hands going up, yeah. How many of you used to be married? You know, yeah, all right. We're going to talk about a lot of this stuff, and I can already feel the tension because there'll be some people in the room that go, oh, we're going to talk about marriage. My kids wouldn't even come today. They said, Dad, what are you talking about? I said, I'm talking about marriage. And they said, well, we're not coming. I said, well, why not? I said, because we're not getting married. You know, it's like, well, you might one day. You should learn to eat with a fork now, and it will help you as an adult. But I want to talk a little bit about marriage. And I understand that everybody is not married. I get that. And some of you might hope to be married one day. Some of you may be on the backside of a marriage that didn't work out very well. In all of this, though, I can assure you, I hope there is a truth that will manifest itself meaningfully in your life with your relationships. Maybe it is a right now marriage. Maybe it is a marriage yet to be. Maybe you're recovering from a bad marriage and you're trying to decide if you should try to get back up to the plate and do it again. Maybe if you're really, really young, you'll hear something, and when you get married, you'll get it right the first time, and you will avoid some of the hard knocks that so many of us in this room have faced. Marriage is tough. Marriage is glorious. It is wonderful. It is the kind of the ultimate expression of a covenant between two people, and we'll talk about that, but it is not without a lot of turbulence. And we're in the middle of the sermon series called Relationships, and we're talking about what it means to pay attention to a lot of cultural shifts that are bombarding us each and every day and try to hold fast to that which is important. And marriage is one expression of that relationship that is clearly being impacted by so many different cultural shifts. I have the privilege in ministry of doing weddings. And I don't do nearly as many weddings as I used to do. I used to do a ton of weddings, and I didn't do any weddings. And now I just do a handful because I feel it's important to be rooted and grounded in the congregation. And it's not so much that I like doing the weddings, but I love the planning of the weddings. I love meeting with couples, right? Most of the time young, not all the time young, but I love it when couples come to see me and we engage in that process of pre-marriage counseling. They usually come, they're very transparent, they're very vulnerable. Many of them have never sat with a pastor before, and that comes with all kinds of imagery about what that's going to be like and what they should say, and do we sit in the right spot, and do we say the right thing, and do we let him know that we're perfect? And then when they break down those walls and barriers, they begin to share with me some pretty profound stuff. And one of the questions I always ask is, what do you hope for your marriage? And it is amazing to me what they will begin to say, because everybody walks into my office, and they have a giant box, metaphorically speaking, of hopes and wishes and dreams about what their marriage is going to look like. That's normal. And the box is big, and it's full of all kind of stuff. And they will say, when we get married, we hope. And they'll begin to paint a picture of what they hope their marriage looks like. They'll talk about where they hope to live and what they hope to do and how they hope to split their holidays and how they hope to have children and how they hope to raise those children. There are so many hopes and dreams, desires. And I'll say, what do you hope for your husband? He said, I hope that he will greet me when I walk in the door this way. And what do you hope for your wife? And what do you dream about when you think about your wife? Well, I dream that a wife would do this, and then they fill in the blank, blah, blah, blah. And it is a profound moment, very, very special for a pastor. I had one young man. I said, what do you hope, you know, for your marriage? He said, Pastor, just to be honest and confessional, he said, I've been pure, and now I'm excited because I will be able to be physically intimate twice a day. Yeah, and I just said, that's not a hope, that's a fantasy. And it ain't coming true, pal, at all. But that's what happens, right? We have all of this, when I get married, this is what I hope. And it's a picture that we paint. And it is marvelous. And these are legitimate dreams and desires. But one thing I see happen almost every time, almost with every couple. I don't know how. I don't know when it starts. I don't know when they're at the altar or after they've walked out the back aisle. I don't know if it happens on the honeymoon, if it's a week later, if it's a year later. But I can tell you it happens to almost all of us who have ever been in this thing called marriage. At some point, we take the same basket of hopes and dreams and desires, and we move them into a basket of something we call expectation. And when that happens, the marriage breaks down. The relationships break down. And when all of our legitimate hopes and dreams and desires become expectations, the first thing to go is intimacy and romance. And marriage becomes transactional, and it may exist, and it may survive, but it is not the kind of marriage that God had in store for you and that God had in store for me. And too often, I have seen marriage make a transition from a covenant to a contract. And a contract is transactional. And a contract says, this is what you can expect me to do. And then you're obligated by the terms of the contract to do it. And every time this transition happens, the dynamic of a marriage is instantaneously changed. The intimacy, the romance, they evaporate. And as you move from covenant into contract, you move from a paradigm that revolves around unconditional love to a paradigm that revolves around a debt-debtor relationship. And what I mean by that is what we subtly say to our spouses, you owe me. We used to talk about this and have fun about it and laugh about it and plan with our hopes and our dreams and our desires, but I picked all that stuff up and I moved it into the expectation box, and now I expect it. And when I expect it, you know what I'm saying? You owe me. You owe me. And all of us could stand right here today and we could build a convincing and a strong argument about why our spouse owes us. After all, they promised us. We invited all of our friends and family. We spent all of this money and they promised me. But just as you and I have a tendency to justify our debt-debtor relationship, as soon as we enter into it, the dynamic of the marriage changes, and it's not for the positive. It devolves into something that is totally transactional. And it's not the marriage that we set out to have. And once it becomes transactional, there's very little margin, there's very little room for the expression of or the reception of unconditional love. After all, if you expect something and they meet your expectation, aren't they just back to zero? Isn't that just par? Isn't that what they're just supposed to do? And if it's just what they're supposed to do, why would we celebrate it? Why would we honor it? Why would we show gratitude? That's what they're supposed to do. I expected that of you, and you did that. Congratulations, you're up to zero. You just did what I fully expected you to do. This is exactly why nobody in this room has ever received a perfume sprayed, calligraphy written thank you letter of massive gratitude from your mortgage lender that says, congratulations, you fulfilled the terms of your contract. It never happens. Why? Because you signed the paper and that's just what they expected you to do. My hunch is there's a lot of people in this room right now, and you feel that way about your marriage. You ever try to call your bank, make it personal, right? You call your bank, plus one, or say, and then you start talking to a computer and you can't get through, and nothing is personal about it at all, until what? You miss a payment. You miss a payment, they get personal real fast. They won't wait for you to call them and take your call, they'll actually call you. I know this because I have been there. Right? Your phone rings and suddenly there is a, whoa, there's a relationship and it's all negative because you didn't stand up to the terms of the contract. As long as you did everything right, very little communication, but boy, when you do something wrong, I'm going to let you know about it. And I know that's the way a lot of us exist in our relationships. As long as we do everything right, it might be peaceful, it might be civil, but there's not a lot of love and there's not a lot of personal attention. Not the kind you hoped for and dreamt about before you got married. But when you mess up, woo, there's a lot of personalized attention. There's a lot of, we need to talk. But under that umbrella, nobody feels loved. Nobody feels validated. You're just trying to maintain the bar. You're just trying to keep the peace. And probably there are some good times, and probably there are some pleasant times, and maybe you're intimate every now and then because that's what you're supposed to do. But basically, your marriage has devolved into a big, gigantic system for managing expectations. And we're talking about cultural shifts, and the shifts we want to wrestle with this week is the shift that sociologists will tell you that is happening, and that is this. We now expect more from our spouse than we've ever expected before. We want super spouses. And we compare them and we contrast them to our expectations. And we want them to be all things inclusive, and we want them to be everything. We expect more out of our spouses than we have ever expected. Study after study, sociologist after sociologist will tell you this. I love from the words of Esther Perel, marriage used to be an economic institution in which you were given a partnership for life in terms of children and social status and succession and companionship. But now we want our partner to still give us all of these things, but in addition, I want you to be my best friend, and I want you to be my confidant, and I want you to be my passionate lover. And oh yeah, we live twice as long, so you're gonna have to do it for a long, long time. So we come to one person, our soulmate, that we think can meet all of our expectations, and we're basically asking the one person to give us what it used to take an entire village or community to provide. We expect them to make money, right? We expect them to make money and pour into and contribute to the bottom line and take care of the kids and do what a stay-at-home mom does and look like a model and greet me the way that I expect when I walk in the door. And we expect men to provide and be present all the time. Don't miss a practice. To be sensitive and rugged. Expectations. These aren't hopes and dreams. These are expectations. This is you owe me. You owe me. And when people don't meet expectations, really, you got about three options. The first one, you leave. You leave. Right? I'm leaving. You don't meet my expectations. I'm leaving. Or you feel guilty because I don't meet your expectations. And I'm tired of walking in the door every day feeling like a total failure. So I'm out of here. And it's easier than ever to leave. We got options everywhere we go. The dating business now is about a $2.4 billion online dating. Now, online dating is not in and of itself is a bad thing. I'm telling you, if you're single, it's probably a great way to meet people. But I'm always alarmed and amazed at the number of married people engaged with online dating because their spouse doesn't meet expectations. You think about this and how frighteningly dispensable our union to become. If your husband, if he doesn't look like George Clooney, right? If he doesn't take out the trash on time, if he can't possibly afford to fly you to Paris for Valentine's Day, guess what? There are 50 dudes on Match.com right now whose profile says they will. That's what we're up against. You think the invitation to leave has ever been easier? We compare and we contrast, and we have more romantic options than we've ever had in the history of the world. I was reading a book, and it said, your cell phone basically is like a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week singles bar in your pocket at all times. We have more options than we have ever had. And the gravitational pull to say, you know what, they don't meet your expectations. You should find someone who does. And so we pack up our bag of expectations, and you know what? We just hand it off to somebody else, and we try it again. Is that the option that God wants for us? Second thing we do is sometimes the stronger partner wins, right? You both got expectations, and there's always a dominant partner. And so one of them is so exhaustingly convincing about how poor you are at meeting expectations, you just give up, and you just surrender. And you just say, you know what? I'm just tired. You're right. And so you just try to do the best that you can, and you're miserable, and then we try to compromise. That's kind of a third option. We leave, We leave sometimes. We let the stronger partner win sometimes. And sometimes we try to compromise. So compromise in and of itself, that's a healthy word. That's not a bad word. But sometimes in marriage, you got to be careful, right? Compromise says you do your part, I'll do my part, and we'll just get through this. You know what we're really committed to, Paul? We're committed to our marriage. I hear that a lot. We're really committed to our marriage. Guess what? The Bible doesn't call you to be committed to your marriage. The Bible calls you to be committed to a person. That's different. Marriage is just the means to the end. The call from God is to be committed not to the institution, to the person. So if you've duped yourself and you're just committed to your marriage, you've just compromised. And is that what God really wants you to do? Can you imagine if we could get it all back, though? And go back to those days where we took everything out of the expectation bag and we put it in the dream hope bag and we talked about, gee, one day I hope we could live like this. Can you imagine if that were possible? Can you imagine coming home and walking in the door and not having to bear the extraordinary weight of a failed expectation? Because you probably didn't feel that weight when you were dating. There's something that happens that makes marriage go from a covenant to a contract. And one of the reasons that I think it happens is that we forget it's not a covenant between two people. There's actually a third party involved. If you are a Christian, there's a third party involved. God, the third cord. And about 1,000 years before Christ, there was a guy named Solomon who was incredibly wealthy. History would say he was the wealthiest person that's ever lived. He had seen a lot, he had done a lot, he experienced a lot, and he wrote down a lot about what God values. In the Old Testament, there's a book called Ecclesiastes, which just means gathering. It's a gathering of wisdom. And if you don't pay much attention to the Bible, or you're here today and you've never read the Bible, or if you're here today and you think, well, the Bible's not even true. I happen to think it's true, but if you think it's not even true, guess what? It works. And so Ecclesiastes might be a great place to start because it's just wisdom. And it works. Solomon said this works, and he wrote this down. And I've tried to share this at every wedding I've ever done in my life. Ecclesiastes 4, starting with verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. Now, all of that sounds well and good. There's one cord and there's another cord. There's a strand and there's a strand. And two strands are better than a single strand. And if one strand falls, woe to that one that falls and doesn't have somebody else to help out. And if one strand lies down in the cold, wow, it'd be great to have another strand to keep you warm. And if one strand gets attacked, wouldn't it be better to have some defenses in your foxhole? Of course it would. And all brides and grooms go, yeah, 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 I love that passage. That's us. Read that one, Paul. But they forget the last line. Solomon slips this in, but this is the linchpin. This is the thing that is so important. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Whoa, 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 what? No, I get the two strands. I found my strand. And I'm fired up about my strand. And we got all these hopes and dreams. And Solomon says, yeah, but two strands, that's a breakable cord. In fact, it breaks a lot. Just because there's benefit in one strand hooking up with another strand doesn't mean that that's not a breakable cord. In fact, it breaks more times than it sticks. But it is a three-cord strand that is impossible to break. What in the world is he talking about? What is the third cord? There's a third party. There's a third party. He's talking about God. That these two cord strands are totally breakable. We see it all the time, but it's this two cords that when they invite the third cord to wrap itself around them, that's when you've got a cable that you can't break. That's what a marriage looks like. And this gets back to expectations, because what we tend to do is assign expectations to the wrong strand. And there's a third strand that we never assign expectations to. We put them all on our spouse. But did you know that your spouse can only do what a spouse can do. There's a third cord that can do a lot more than your spouse. The reason why two cords are so breakable is because we expect the strand to do something that it was never wired or designed to do in the first place. And we forget about the third strand, God. So we put all these expectations on the very source that cannot comply. So Paul, what are you talking about? Do you know that your strand cannot fix you? Your spouse cannot fix you. That's an expectation that we put upon our spouses all the time. They're going to fix me. And that's one that we take. We take that responsibility all the time, and we think, I'm going to fix them. And the reality is, sometimes you just kind of messed up before you get married, and then you get married. Well, guess what? You're still messed up. And your spouse cannot fix you. And you cannot fix your spouse. That is an expectation that can never, ever, ever, ever be met. And we do it every day. We think we can fix our spouse, and then we live with guilt because we did not succeed. And we live with guilt because we have a failed expectation. And then we think our spouse can somehow fix us and is somehow responsible for our behavior and our shortcoming. And they cannot. They were not wired to fix us. They are not capable of fixing us. They don't have the wisdom to fix us. They don't have the strength. They don't have the divine supernatural capacity to fix us. Only God can fix you. And it takes your cooperation. Why would you assign that expectation to the one source that can't? Right? It's like trying to boil water with snow. You can't, it can't do it. It's an impossible journey. And how many people in this room are gonna be happy when they fix their spouse or when their spouse fixes them? You can't do it. You know what else you can't do? You can't complete them. Who invented that? I mean, that's the, do you complete me? What? It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. No, you don't. Everybody has a God size and a God shaped hole in their heart, and it will never be complete by another human being. It will only be complete by God. Why do we think our spouse can complete us in all of our deficiencies? This is the way Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians, for now we see only a reflection in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now I know only in part, I am incomplete, but then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known by who? Not my spouse, by the third strand. Only God can complete you. Make you a better person, that's another one. My spouse, they make me a better person. Why do you want to get married? I ask that all the time. Why do you want to get married? Because they make me a better person. No, they don't. They can't make you a better person. They can't make you a worse person. You're in charge of your own shortcomings. You're in charge of your own decisions. They cannot make you a better person. They might could invite you and lead you into an environment where you have an opportunity to be a better person. But being a better person is between you and the third strand. That's it. We shouldn't expect our spouses to do what only God can do. And in my own marriage, every time I get locked and loaded on Ashley's desires and dreams, as long as I am focused on expectations, and as long as I assign expectations to Ashley that only God can do, we struggle. And we only thrive when we allow that third cord to wrap the divine presence of God Almighty around our lives, to allow the focus of having expectations met be placed on the right source. And look, I'm not naive and understand, well, you know, Paul, you have a good marriage because you're a pastor and because you read the Bible from time to time. And you, no, come on. I'm not naive. I know the pushback. I have seen it all. I've experienced it all. I have every story imaginable. People that come through my office, they have told me everything, and they'll say, you don't understand how bad it is, Paul. You don't know. Yes, I do, because I've heard it all. Every time somebody comes to my office, they never come by to say, Paul, we just came by to tell you we're doing great. Marriage rocks. Ever. They come by with their stories about how poorly it's going. I've heard all the stories. You don't know my husband. If I don't keep him on a short leash, you don't know what will happen. Well, I can't put $5 in my wife's hand. You do not know what she will do with $5 in her hand. You do not know my story. I'm concerned that he will, and I'm concerned that she will. I've heard everything. The only way out is the third strand. You say, okay, but realistically, what do I do with all these expectations? Because they started out as hopes and dreams, and am I just supposed to do like whatever, and whatever they do and however they live, that's okay. I just got to accept everything? No. And particularly, I'm not talking about staying in an abusive relationship, right? What do we do with the expectations? The Bible gives us an answer. First Peter, who was married, Peter who knew Jesus, said this, "All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another." There it is. What do we do with all those expectations? All those failed expectations, all that anxiety, all that stress, because they're not the husband that I dreamt and desired they would be. What do I do? Peter would say, all of you, who? All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another. Biblical humility. That's not like you're a general, I'm a sergeant, therefore when I'm in your presence, I'm all humble and I recognize that you're better than me. That's not biblical humility. Biblical humility is something different. Biblical humility is you have a deal and I have a deal. And I'm going to put your deal before my deal. That's what biblical humility is. Peter says this is the key. All of you clothe yourselves with humility, putting the deal of your loved ones before your deal. Well, why, Peter? Because God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. You want to invite the third strand into your life and you don't know how to do it? It starts with humility, putting their deal before your deal. If you don't do that, God says, I resist that. I oppose that. Good luck. See you at the top. Hope it works out. But when you say, no, I'm going to put their deal before my deal, that's when God says, whoa, I favor that. I love that. I will give grace to that. And grace, by the way, is not the grace of salvation that gets you into heaven. This is grace that says, I'm going to empower you to do what you need to do while you need to do it when you're frustrated about all the expectations that are not being met. That's what the favor looks like. That's what the grace looks like. When we say, I'm going to freely put their deal in front of my deal, Peter says that's the mindset that God is looking for. That is the mindset that God favors. He resists the proud. He resists those that say, you know what, we don't need the third strand. We got this all figured out, and my deal is more important than yours, so I'm going to convince you how important my deal is. God says, okay, good luck. I'm going to sit over here and resist that. But the second you start living a life where you say, I'm putting their deal before mine, God says, I'm in. I'm about to wrap myself around your relationship. And we're going to make this whole darn thing unbreakable. It's the third cord. It's the third cord. He gives grace to the humble. That's what we're all looking for. And sometimes it takes a while. Verse 6, and we're done. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up. That's what you want, right? God to lift you up in due time. Oh, I want it in my time. I need it by Monday. I heard the sermon on Sunday. I want action in my marriage on Monday. Peter says, look, God is favoring you in due time. And in the meantime, while due time is going on, God will provision you with the grace to do what you need to do in the moment to sustain a healthy relationship. But it starts with that humility. Then he wraps with this, cast all of your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Take all your expectations that your spouse cannot ever meet and assign them to God. God says, you got expectations? Bring them on. I want them all. Bring them on. But stop asking your spouse to do what only I can do. And you say, God said, bring it on. I'm bringing it on. And some of you have lived this out like crazy. Some of you could stand up here right now and you would put this sermon to shame because you've seen God reward you in your marriage. But it started with a different paradigm and taking all of those things that you've put in an expectation box and picking them up and putting them back in the desire, hope, and dream box. And when you do that, you got a shot at one heck of a marriage. So my prayer for all of us is that we'll do that. And we'll stop living a contractual relationship based on expectation. Let's pray. Lord, would you bless all the marriages in this room, all of them? And would you help us to start with humility, as hard as that is? And would you help us to trust that you will favor us and provision us with the grace to figure it out in due time? And would you grant us the patience to honor due time? And for everyone that's not married, Lord, would you help them to craft a paradigm and a way of thinking and a way of dealing with each other so that when they do get married, they would do so in a healthy fashion? And Lord, finally, would you bless everyone here that is the function and the product of a failed marriage and they're struggling with guilt? Would you just remove it from them and help them to step up to the plate of meaningful relationships again? And this time, to do it in the way that you want them to do it. In your son's name we pray. Amen.